So welcome everybody. Today we are very happy to have Gabor Sarosi from CERN, and he will give the talk with the following title: Comments on the Volume of the Black Hole Interior into Deep Gravity. Please keep your microphones muted and only unmute if you want to ask questions. Gabor, the stage is yours.
Yeah, so thank you very much for this invitation. So yeah, I'm going to talk about some work that I have done with Luca Iliescu and Mark Mezei here in this preprint here. And so that will be roughly half of the talk, and then I will tell you something about that's work in progress with Luca, Mark, and Alexei Milakin. Okay. So here's the plan. So first I will start with a short motivation. So this will be quite brief. I think hopefully most of us have heard this part in some version before. And then I will go on to tell you about how can we calculate and what does the volume of the interior how can we find a microscopic formula in a particular 2D theory of gravity called JT gravity. And then in the last part, I will speculate on the microscopic interpretation of what we find. Okay, so that's the plan. Okay, so let's start with the motivation. So what we want to understand is the growth of the black hole interior, especially in the context of ADS-CFT. So if you have a black hole, two-sided black hole in ADS, this is how it looks like. And if you start to move ahead in time, then you see that this kind of wormhole connecting the two sides is getting longer and longer, larger and larger. In particular, the volume of the maximal Cauchy slice connecting two times here that are fixed at the boundary grows with t linearly. Okay, so the question is really, what is the microscopic origin of this creation of space? So how space is getting created here? In particular, we think that entanglement has to do something with how space-time emerges in ADS-CFT. But in this case, it's you have a situation where the entanglement between the two sides doesn't change when move ahead in time, but still this wormhole is getting longer and longer. Okay. So this is the motivation. And then this is something that should be a property of a time evolved term of the double state, which is the holographic dual of this eternal black hole. So what kind of property could it be? So conventional properties are not going to do it because they thermalize in short times while this wormhole grows for a long time. So basically, a proposal by Susskind and others is that it has to do with something that you might call complexity, something that knows about the preparation of the state or the history of the state. And if you think about quantities that you could call complexity, then they have the following behavior. They have a long linear growth, which is what is conjectured to basically captured by this growth of the length of the wormhole. And then after you reach times that are very large, exponentially large in the number of degrees of freedom in the entropy of the system, and then you kind of run out of space, and then this thing needs to thermalize and it plateaus at some very large value. Okay, so this is what semi-classical gravity captures, this eternal growth. And then today what I'm going to tell you about is how to see in gravity this saturation, or at least that's going to be one part of what I'm going to tell you about. Okay, so that's the plan. And then before I start, I just want to comment on why do we even think that we have a chance of seeing something like this in gravity. It's exponentially late in the entropy. So it's very non-perturbative. And the reason is because one lesson from recent years, decades, is that Euclidean gravity seems to have an unreasonably large regime of validity. And from the recent years, two famous examples are this. So essentially, it's just looking at Euclidean gravity, you can learn about universal energy level repulsion in chaotic systems, which is something about the how the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian work. So it's something that it should just not know about, but it still knows about. And you can also derive the entropy of the Page curve of an evaporating black hole, which is again something about unitarity of the time evolution. Okay, and the one common thing about all these things is that they have to do about with summing over topologies, so non-trivial topologies in the Euclidean path integral. Okay, so today in this theory in JT gravity, where we have a control over these sum over topologies, we will ask the question how these effects affect the volume of the interior. Okay. So this was the motivation. Are there any questions? If not, so let me move on to describe the volume in JT gravity. Okay, so this is JT gravity. This is the action. So there's you have some it's action on two-dimensional manifold. So you have some ground state entropy factor weighted by Euler characteristic, and then you have a metric and a dilaton, so those are degrees of freedom, and you have this simple action with an appropriate boundary term here. Okay, so this is actually a very universal action in two dimensions. So many classes of dilaton gravity theories share the same IR physics as this model, and actually it arises as a kind of the IR limit of the near horizon region of near extrema black holes, so very long, nearly ADS2 throats. Okay, and so how do black holes look like in this theory? So as you can see, if you sort of the equation of motion for this dilaton is just forces geometries to be constant negative curvature. So essentially everything is ADS2 and the dynamics is in the profile of this dilaton. And this is how a black hole looks like in Lorentzian. So you just have ADS2, which is a strip, an infinite strip. But then where you put the ADS2 boundary is a constant large dilaton surface. So your cutoff sets the size of your dilaton, and the constant dilaton surface looks like this on a shell. So essentially you effectively have a horizon between these two boundaries. And if you pick kind of Rindler coordinates, let's say on one side here, then you really find like a 2D Schwarzschild black hole. okay. In the case of the Euclidean continuation of the geometry, you just have the hyperbolic disk with a constant cutoff. So this is just the analog of the Cigar geometry, the usual Euclidean black hole. Okay, so the beauty of JT gravity is that so higher topologies also contribute to the path integral, and you can actually sum them. So this has been shown in beautiful work by Saad, Schenker, and Stanford. So they have non-perturbatively suppressed action. So you're looking at some sum like this. And what you find that this expansion in the genus corresponds to a genus expansion of a matrix integral of a matrix model at large n or large matrix size. So basically, you have this duality between JT gravity and the matrix model. And this duality is basically in this genus expansion and in double scaling limit, where you take the size of the matrix to be infinite. And you zoom to the bottom of the spectrum. Okay, so how does the volume behave and look like in this model? Okay, so let's look at the classical volume. So again, here's a black hole. It's just global ADS with a constant dilaton cutoff surface. And because of the symmetries of constant ADS, an extrema volume slice or an extrema length line here, it's just a straight line. So it's constant in global time, but it has non-trivial dependence in terms of Rindler time, precisely because this cutoff surface falls in. And you can calculate this. It's a simple calculation. You get some analytic formula for the renormalized length, and indeed it grows linearly at large times. Okay, so how do we calculate then, how do we define a quantum version of this quantity? So let's first start with the perturbative definition. So if you stay at genus zero, and you just want to take into account gravitational fluctuations, then you can do it very simply because you know the exact Hartle-Hawking wave function in this model at the level of the disk. So it's a path integral like this. You fix some geodesic length, and then you integrate over these gravitational fluctuations, which are now just these wiggles on the boundary. And this integral turns out to be one loop exact, and you get some fixed expression for this wave function. And once you have this wave function, then you can imagine just, you know, doing like a normal quantum computation where you put this length here as an operator and you integrate overall values of the length with the modulus squared of the wave function of the term of your double state. Okay, so it's just standard quantum mechanics. Okay, so this is at the level of the disk. So what do we do when we want to take into account higher genus surfaces and give a non-perturbative definition? So here's the basic challenge. The basic challenge is that there are, at higher genus surfaces, there are infinite number of extrema geodesics connecting two points. So here's just a basic example at genus one. You know, you can go this way, or you can go this way, or you can go this way, and actually you can go an infinite number of ways. You can see this by kind of cutting this surface open and writing it as part of a hyperbolic disk with identifications. So this surface is the same as identifying the red curves and the blue curves. and then basically, geodesics are just semi-circles that kind of bounce around these identifications. Okay, so and they go from this point to this point. Okay, so what should be the prescription? You could imagine taking the minimal geodesic, but there's a problem with this because the minimal geodesic is, so we want to continue to Lorentzian, and the minimal geodesic is not an analytic function of this time, this Euclidean time, because clearly if you start to move one endpoint, it starts to jump around. So we want to do something that has an analytic continuation to Lorentzian, and also we want something that's intrinsically quantum, so doesn't kind of select like a saddle point. Okay, so this is kind of the prescription or the definition that we go with. We just say that, okay, we sum over these surfaces, and on each surface we sum over all the geodesics. Okay, it's a very democratic thing to do. With the appropriate weighting factor. But the problem, of course, that this is divergent, because as I told you, there are infinite number of geodesics going between two points, and they are longer and longer. They wind certain cycles more times and so on. But this divergence is actually turns out to be kind of harmless. So we just go ahead and regulate it. So one natural regularization is to replace instead of the length, you sum over something that decays with longer lengths. So you could pick exponential of minus some delta, which is the regulator, times the length. And then you can just bring down the length by a derivative and send delta to zero. So in this case, what you have here is related to the two-point function. So it's basically a two-point function, but you could imagine using some other regulator. The claim is that the divergent piece in this sum doesn't depend on time, so how you move the endpoint of the geodesic. Okay, so this is the definition that we want to calculate. Okay, so how does the actual calculation go? So I won't give you a lot of details, just want to give you a flavor of it. So essentially, at the disk level, we had this quantum expectation value with the Hartle-Hawking wave function. And now when we go to higher genus, we will basically still, what we will do is that we have one boundary and we cut it open along a geodesic and insert there what we want to have there. So this exponential factor, and then integrate over with the appropriate measure. So here we have this modulus squared, and here we will have some two bounded, like over integral over some moduli here that connects these trumpets or half trumpets here to a two boundary Riemann surface. So what will appear here is like a two boundary Riemann surface moduli, a space volume. Okay, so as you can see, there's no sum over geodesics here, and really the magic is that we just use Mirzakhani's recursion relation, which allows you to turn the sum over the non-intersecting geodesics into a reduction in the size of the moduli space. So if you remember, we have started here with a one boundary Riemann surface. So essentially the magic that happens is that that this gets turned into the moduli space of a two boundary Riemann surface. Okay. Good. So once you go over this, you find the following formula. So because you have two boundaries, you get double trace quantity in the matrix model, so the insertion of two spectral densities, and you get a formula like this. So if you are familiar with the spectral form factor, then this is a very, very similar formula to that. So there's two, you integrate over two energy levels in the matrix model, and then there's a density-density correlation function, and you have some Fourier factors here. And if you didn't have this kernel here, then this would be the spectral form factor, but instead here you get a kernel that has this explicit form. So what does this kernel do? The interesting property of it is in the case when the energies come close together. So in this case, it has a double pole. So this is the behavior that's relevant at late times. So as you can see, time in this Fourier integral couples to energy differences. So when you take times very long, then it's dominated by the small energy difference behavior of this integral. Okay, so this double pole is very important. And then we can just go ahead and non-perturbatively complete JT gravity into a matrix model and use this density-density correlator, which is universal in all matrix models. So it has this kind of form. It has a disconnected piece, so that's the classical contribution. In terms of gravity, it comes from just a product of two disks. There's a kind of delta function part here. So this would give you a divergence here, because when it meets with this double pole, that's not very good, but this is actually something that gets regulated, this double pole, by the delta. But you can see that it's a time-independent divergence, because precisely because the divergence comes from coinciding energies here, which couples to time. Okay, and then the star of the show is this sine kernel here. So there are two components to this. There's a power law decay, so that's level repulsion in random matrix theories. And in terms of gravity, it comes from this kind of wormhole, this double trumpet that connects two boundaries. And then there's the sine part that actually regulates this double ball here that you have from level repulsion and makes it finite when the energies actually become the same. And in terms of, so this is a doubly non-perturbative from the point of view of gravity, this contribution. Okay, very good. So now you can sort of just plug in this formula into the integral and you get the orange curve. You can, if you numerically evaluate it. You can also just analyze its asymptotics. So at early times, it has this linear growth that we have seen from the classical result. And then it saturates in this particular way to this exponentially large value. Okay, so things are exponentially large and exponentially late in terms of this parameter S0. That weights the different topologies in the theory. Okay, so let me now compare to the spectral form factor. So if you haven't seen the spectral form factor, it's something that has been discussed a lot for black holes in recent years. It's essentially a partition function, analytically continued in temperature. to complex temperatures, and we interpret the imaginary part as time and the absolute value square of that. And if you look at random matrix theory, you also average this. So this is something that's a two-density quantity as well. So once you average it, essentially you get this formula that I was mentioning before. And it's a very similar formula that I have been showing you for the volume instead. But there's a kernel here for the volume, which is one for the spectral form factor. So these are the behaviors that you have in universally in random matrices in the GUE class. So for the volume, as I explained, it has this behavior, and for the form factor, it has some kind of decay that's called the slope, and then there's a dip here, and then there's a universal linear ramp, and then it saturates in a plateau. So I just want to highlight like which part comes from where. So the classical piece, the classical computation in the case of the volume just gives you something that grows forever, while in the case of the form factor, it gives you something that decays forever. So this is a log plot. So actually, this is some exponential decay here to zero. So this is something that would become zero classically. And then the rest of the curve comes from this sine kernel. So in the case of the form factor, this sine kernel, both the level repulsion and the sine part, gives you a curve like this. So all the late time part of the curve, and actually you can separate that power law here that comes from the wormhole. It gives you this linear rise called the ramp, and then the sine is responsible for this growth ending eventually and saturating in a plateau. On the other hand, for the volume, it's quite different because this combination, it just gives you, it stays zero. It's some very small contribution for a long time. And then it just gives you a negatively growing part that exactly cancels the classical piece. So it's a very large cancellation that happens between two large things here. So it's very surprising, and it's actually, you know, like here, this cancellation is different than this cancellation, because here this one happens entirely in the quantum part, while this one happens between the classical piece and the quantum piece. So that's a kind of interesting aspect of this. Okay, so let me then move on to the microscopic interpretation, unless there are any questions. Okay, so the final formula that I have shown for the volume, so one particularly important comment about it is that it makes sense in any matrix integral because it just depends on a spectral two-point function. And even more importantly, you can derive it in more general theories of 2D Dilaton gravity. So this is can be done in terms of summing certain conical defects with methods developed in these two papers. And you find the same formula. So this gives some credence in the actual microscopic formula, and you can just introduce a new quantity where you just remove the matrix model average and you consider this kind of double sum with a double pole here in terms of energies, and you make all this spectral complexity. So that's what the definition or how I will call this this quantity. And then the question is, does this have, like, this is now a microscopic quantity that you can calculate in any quantum system, and does it have some interpretation? So what does it mean? So that's what we have been banging our heads on in the last few months. So I will tell you a couple of things that we understood, but there are lots of things we're still confused about. So from this point on, it's very much under construction. So here's an extremely simple proxy for what complexity is supposed to do in a quantum system. So let's just ask a much simpler question about time evolution. It's just how much of the Hilbert space is spent if you take a state, the term of your double state, and you start to time evolve it, and you keep the states in the past. So you have all these states, and then you just take the span and like how much of the Hilbert space you get this way. So this is something about the history of the state. It's not a conventional quantum probe, but let's try to answer this question. So if these were orthogonal states, you would do something like this to measure this. You would construct some projector to this set of states. So this would be now an integral of these pure state density matrices from zero to some time. So capital T will be the time now, the end time, and some average of these things. And this is really like a legit density matrix. It's trace one and it's positive definite. The only problem is that these are not orthogonal projectors. So your first guess where you would measure this size by just the rank of this density matrix is wrong, because basically it instantly becomes full rank because it has extremely small eigenvalues, which come basically from the fact that this guy has matrix elements with any time with this term of your double states. Okay, so what do we do? We can just look at, replace the rank of the matrix with, let's say, the number of eigenvalues that are bigger than some threshold. So that's a parameter that we introduce. Let's call it epsilon. So this will be rank epsilon, and we just count the number of eigenvalues that have a lambda bigger than epsilon. You could write it in terms of, let's say, a theta function. So how is this a proxy for complexity? So now I will give you some definition of complexity that it's a proxy for, and try to provide you an intuition of how it relates to more conventional notions of complexity. So you could consider an ensemble of states. So this is a set of quantum states, and you could define complexity of this ensemble as the minimum number of some quantum gates of your selection that are needed to prepare all states in this ensemble. So this is a definition that was employed by Roberts and Yoshida, and they actually gave a simple lower bound on this definition of complexity. And it's just a simple counting argument. And essentially it gives you a bound of this form. So this notion of complexity is bigger than, there's some order one factor here coming from, like what's your gate set choice and so on. So there's some ambiguity there, but the what measures kind of the size of this ensemble is this part here. So you have the log of the number of states basically in the ensemble. If you have a continuous ensemble, then you introduce some kind of, tolerance, and then you count the number of states with that tolerance. Okay, so the connection with more conventional notions of complexity is that you can argue that this C of E should roughly be the complexity of the most complex state in the set. Okay, so here is just the end of the previous slide, and now I will try to connect it to what I have been saying before about this time average density matrix. So now let's consider a particular ensemble. So it should be this subspace of eigenvectors which have eigenvalue bigger than this epsilon. Okay, so how many states are in this ensemble? So you want to introduce some threshold, and then you want to count the volume of this this state ensemble. And since, because it's a linear subspace, the physical distinct states, the space of physically distinct states is just proportional to Cp to the dimension minus one, whose volume is goes exponentially. So it's pi to this power times some factors. Okay, very good. So these are the number of states here. So we have connected these to this regularized rank that I have introduced before. And then from the bound of Roberts and Yoshida, you find that this complexity here is lower bounded by this rank. Okay, so by the way, yeah, I should just mention that lower bounds on complexity are the hard bounds in general. And this you might expect to be quite tight. Okay, so now it is also tempting to think, although we cannot show this, that in this set, in this E of t that we're looking at, the most complex state is the term of a double with highest time. So it's clear why, you know, like term of a doubles at lower times are less complex, but the problem here is that you can also superpose these states when you're in this set. And then the argument here is basically that superposing states that are, you know, look like the same unitary act at different times is generically cheap. So there are quantum circuits to do this, but it does have some overhead. Okay, so this is the intuition why you might think that that this is the most complex state or among the most complex states in the ensemble. Okay, great. So we have this kind of relation of the rank or this regulated rank to complexity. So we want to focus now on this regulated rank. But while this is, you know, like in quantum mechanics, a well-defined quantity, I gave you a definition, it's here. In gravity or so in gravity this would be hard to calculate. So how would you calculate it from a complicated density matrix? So instead of this, we will do a further lower bound. So there's a simple lower bound on this quantity, and this just follows from Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. So you use Cauchy-Schwarz for this kind of theta function, and you will get the second Rényi entropy here. So you have this expression here, and then you can sort of minimize this over all states. So this is minimal for the maximally mixed state. And then from this, you know, after you rearrange, you just find that this regulated rank is lower bounded by the inverse of second Rényi entropy. Okay, so this is what I will call effective dimension, this inverse of second Rényi entropy. Yeah, so here the caveat is that so there's no epsilon dependence on the right, and then the epsilon dependence is hiding here. So this bound is only true if epsilon is chosen to be smaller than the inverse of the Hilbert space dimension. Okay, so now I have gave you a lot of motivation why I should look at this second Rényi entropy. And so let me then just go ahead and look at this second Rényi entropy for this time average density matrix. So what you find in this case, so this is now simple to calculate, let's say in terms of just energy basis. So it's a simple calculation, and then you find some formula like this, where this quantity C of 2t looks like this, what I have written here. So this is exactly what I call the spectral complexity, and what the volume in 2D gravity is at late time. So what basically what people would call holographic complexity is in JT gravity. Okay, so this is a kind of complicated, or not so complicated, but it's not like a proportionality between this effective dimension and this quantity here. So it's not really trivial that they behave kind of the same way, but they do have a qualitatively similar behavior. So it turns out that if you have a quantity here that grows linearly for a long time and then saturates, then this other quantity will do the same thing, but in general with different slopes and saturation values. Okay, but it's still true that it happens exponentially late and towards some exponentially large values. Okay, so here's kind of the pro of what I have told you, or the positive things about it. So I have gave you a quantity that's a proxy for for, let's say, circuit complexity. And it's a direct function of the late time volume in gravity. It's not proportional to it, but it's a direct function of it. But there's a lot of cons. So why we might not be satisfied. So first of all, this effective dimension, it has a different early time slope. So actually at early times, you have this ratio here, which is very small. So this quantity is dominated by this term. So the early time behavior is t squared over what the volume does. So it's still linear, but the coefficient is the inverse. And actually, if you restore dimensions in JT gravity, it's the kind of boundary volume of the dilaton that makes up the, or boundary value of the dilaton that makes up the dimensions. So this is a kind of small slope. So in this sense, it's not a very good lower bound. And the other important thing to notice here is that saturation of this volume here is just not needed for the saturation of this quantity here. So that's also something that you might not like. So indeed, if this thing grew forever linearly, it would still be true that you divide by t squared. So at very large times, this thing goes to zero and this thing will still saturate. Okay, so let me give you some further cons. What we are looking at right now is switchback states. So if you really want to understand what's the microscopic dual of the volume, of course, you shouldn't just look at the term of your double state. You should understand it in all states. So the first step that we can do towards this is to just perturb the state with an operator. So this is the kind of picture that you can have in mind. You have the term of your double state dual to a black hole, and you put an operator at some minus time to. Okay, so the way you would prepare a state like this is that you go back in time on your contour to to, and you insert your operator, and you come back. And if you just think about, let's say the complexity of this preparation, then essentially what you find is that the complexity should behave like this. So it should be like twice the length of the contour with a subtraction, where this is the scrambling time, this T star. And it appears because these two parts of the contour cancel when the effect of this operator is not large. So this is a small perturbation. So in its vicinity, these contours roughly cancel, but then it grows large because of the chaotic dynamics. And then the contours don't cancel anymore. And this is something that in general, we know that the volume, the extremal volume does satisfy in ADS and this type of behavior. So on the other hand, this notion of effective dimension that I gave you, it would give you a kind of natural way of what you should calculate in states like this. So essentially, you're supposed to average the states over time evolution and create a state like with this procedure. So you would basically first go back in time like this, and then you would look at the state at this time, you would add the perturbations. So these are the O's, and then you go forward in time. So if this O was not here, then basically there would be a cancellation here between these two terms, but this way there isn't. On the other hand, if you want to just focus on the second Rényi entropy of this density matrix, you can convince yourself that it only depends on the two-point function of this operator. So it cannot possibly know about this scrambling time. So you probably need some more refined quantity in order to understand these formulas. And then basically, so what should you do? And that's what we're doing now. You should just consider these states and see whether you can find a microscopic formula in these states in JT gravity. This requires studying gravitational scattering, which is governed by a particular 6J symbols of SL2R in JT gravity. So So stay tuned for what we have, what we will hopefully find by this analysis. Okay, so let me summarize the talk. So I have gave you a regularized definition of the volume of the interior that is valid non-perturbatively in JT gravity. And then I showed that this definition saturates at times that are exponentially large in the entropy, which is also something that you would expect from various notions of complexity. So the result that you find is similar to the spectral form factor, but the origin of the ramp and the plateau are quite different, because for the volume, there's a large cancellation needed between non-perturbative corrections and classical contribution for the saturation to happen. Okay, and the volume is dual to a simply calculable quantity, at least in the term of the double state, and I have gave a name for it, called it spectral complexity. Okay, so here are the questions that don't let us sleep, and that I have elaborated on. So first of all, can the spectral complexity match some definition of complexity or give a bound? Is the time average density matrix relevant at all? What is it meaning? It hasn't been really studied before. Seems like a natural object. And then what can we say about other states than the term of the double? I didn't have another question, so I guess I will just put this back. Sorry about it, it quit. Yeah, so thank you for the attention. I will just put the final slide here. Yeah.
Thank you very much for a very interesting talk. Are there any questions for Gabor?
Hi, Gabor. Can I ask a question? If you go back to the first half and your non-perturbative definition, at one point it seemed like you were summing over all geodesics. Is this a new definition of complexity? Like, usually I think of the volume as a saddle point of something. Are you saying I should just sum over all?
So I'm summing over basically the extremal ones. Okay. On higher genus surfaces. So there's a unique one when the topology is trivial, so when we consider the disk. Okay. But there are infinite number of discrete ones when we are on a higher genus surface. And then the proposal is to take them on the same footing, but this is you could say a choice.
But when you're summing over wiggles, that doesn't mean that you're summing over all nearby trajectories or?
These are wiggles of the boundary.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's okay. It's like the perturbative part of the gravitational path integral, which in JT gravity just turns into this kind of Schwarzian mode. So that's what I meant here. And then there's also you're supposed to integrate over moduli space at the higher genus. So, yeah.
Okay. I see. I'll have to think about that. So in your saturation, you were pointing out that there's this sort of classical quantum cancellation. Is that something that, well, I guess generally I'm going to ask you, you know, how much of this or what insights do you think we've gotten now about higher dimensions? And maybe I should just ask that question and you can
Yeah, so I should have put that on the final slide among the questions, but maybe one thing that I can add is that there is this, depends on how much we believe it for, in general, near-extremal black holes, but of course, JT gravity has this this relation of describing the IR of a large class of, mm-hmm. not all, but for a large class of near-extremal black holes. In that case, you're sort of looking at the volume of inside these near extremal long black hole throats. So this is one comment, and related to this, you know, it's like very late time physics, mm-hmm. what we're talking about here. And you might expect that, and this is also true for the spectral form factor. So, you know, when you're at very, very late times, the size, if you have a system with finite size, which is required for the discrete spectrum anyways, the size of it becomes kind of irrelevant, and it just becomes like some quantum mechanical system. And you would imagine that at very late times, it's only sort of spectral properties that matter. So from this point of view, I think it might be this particular mechanism of saturation. It has a chance of being like the general thing that happens.
Okay. So that was, I enjoyed your talk. Thanks. Hold on. I think Dominic wants to ask something.
Oh, I was just going to sort of follow up on what you said. So on the slide you have on the screen, I mean, how much does what you do actually depend on like a additional measure factor you could have for like how you weigh different, different geodesics?
That's a good question. So since like you could put in some arbitrary weighting, and then I don't know how you calculate the result, so it's difficult to compare, but maybe one additional technical comment I can make that is about the choice is that actually what we do here, or what we can calculate, is when you're not summing over all geodesics. So I was like slightly sweeping under the rug something there, but only geodesics that do not self-intersect. So this is what gives you the technically nice formula. And it's kind of a choice, but on the other hand, you can make an argument that if you did include geodesics that self-intersect with the same weight, then they would not affect the late time behavior. So they should give something that stays exponentially small in the entropy and should not grow. So this argument is basically, it just comes from the fact that if you have some geodesic that self-intersects, and you want to cut the manifold along it, then you're sort of having a kind of internal boundary for this cut manifold that doesn't couple to any of the boundary parameters like the time and so on. So you get some higher point spectral density, and then there's no parameter that would send that into some coincident limit. It's either highly suppressed at all times, or it does something weirder already at early times. So that's one aspect where, you know, changing something small in the definition doesn't matter or doesn't seem to matter. There's also this question of regulator. So that's also something that turns out to not matter. But there are, of course, other type of choices involved that you just, you know, you can't calculate it with other choices. And so it needs some thinking whether they could change the result or not.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Are there any more questions?
So I can't resist. I've heard that you can think about other objects other than just the volume. Does your analysis lend itself to, for example, having integrals of, I don't know, the dilaton or derivatives of the dilaton along the geodesic, or would it all kind of fall apart when you start trying to do this sum over moduli space?
I think it should be somehow possible to do that. So simply because, yes, I haven't really looked into this in detail, but just because the phase space of these hard-locking wave functions, like for the hard-locking wave function, only depends on this geodesic parameter, and the classical phase space is two-dimensional, so it's like double this geodesic length and time. So I would imagine that any kind of quantity that you can write down that's gauge invariant will end up reducing to be some function of these two things. So it's going to be, you know, a combination of this L, this geodesic length, and derivatives with respect to it.
Okay.
And then that's the thing that you're supposed to stick in inside these calculations. And I think that's something that's doable and one can analyze it. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you mess around with that, if it might lend itself to landing on a quantity that has a simpler boundary interpretation, or if it would just complicate.
Yeah, I think that's worth thinking about. I think it's a doable.
Okay.
Line of inquiry, yeah.
And just because we've gone in that direction, what about codimension zero observables, like space-time volume? Is that something that you think, like somehow then you're on a Lorentzian sheet already, but.
Yeah, so the comment that I can say is the same. So probably it's even more complicated than the codimensional zero one, but in the end, it should be a function on phase space. So you should be able to write it in terms of the extremal volume and the time difference. And it might be like a very complicated function now because it kind of, you know, in terms of the bulk, it relates things that are related by equation of motion to each other, at least in the bulk. But in the end, it should be some generic function like that. So when you quantize it, you just replace the conjugate variable with derivatives. And yeah, so I think the most general kind of phase space observable should be some arbitrary combination of derivatives and functions of L inserted in these formulas.
Okay. That's interesting. Thanks.
If there are no more questions, let's take Gabor again.